you need to be an informed voter and exercise your franchise to vote.
So I got a question for you. In regards to minimum wage, there's been a huge movement to get a $15 minimum wage. Seattle passed it. There's a movement in Portland, but Oregon's more restrictive. They won't let a city just increase the minimum wage by themselves. Who do you know that's trying to increase the minimum wage nationally?
Well, on a national level, I know that Senator Merkley has is behind the he's I don't know that he has co-sponsored the legislation, but I know that he is in favor of that legislation. I can only talk about the folks that we deal with here in Oregon. As far as That's the rest right. of the national side of it, I know that the that it's easy to figure out by looking at the voting record of the folks in your district who stands for working people and who don't. It's very easy. The AFL-CIO has more information on this. We can get you that information if you need it, but I will tell you that if you go into the congressional record and look at who voted for minimum wage legislation that was up this last cycle, folks who voted to privatize Social Security and Medicare, folks who are anti-workers' rights, that information is easily gleaned from the website on the national websites.
Well, that's just about all the time we have tonight. As much as I would love to talk about this stuff for another hour with you guys, I want to say a special thanks to Fred Smith for coming down to educate us on the pension reforms that are going on. And I want to thank Kyle from NATCA and Chris also, who's not in front of a microphone right now. You guys are doing a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us, Nick.
Have a good night, everyone.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, The Director's Cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that three-day cultural event. Director Michael Wadley worked with over 300 hours of footage to create his original 225-minute Director's Cut. Again, that's Woodstock, The Director's Cut at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, The Director's Cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that three-day cultural event. Director Michael Wadley worked with over 300 hours of footage to create his original 225-minute Director's Cut. Again, that's Woodstock, The Director's Cut at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Portland Hawthorne Hostel's 11th annual Bike-In Movie on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. The film will be True Fans, an award-winning documentary about an epic cross-country bicycle journey of three men traveling to the Basketball Hall of Fame and discovering the real America along the way. Musical entertainment will be provided by Train River, an eclectic collection of bluegrass and string band musicians. Again, that's the 11th annual Bike in Movie showing of True Fans on Saturday, August 23rd from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Portland Hawthorne Hostel, 3031 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening. You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO. I'm Justin Chapin, your host for the next half hour. On August 3rd, Tony, who was a friend of mine, called in from a maximum security prison in Massachusetts for an interview with Prison Pipeline. Tony's guilt is in doubt by many of those close to him. There were reverses in key witness testimony and immediate confiscation of his estate by his accusers. However, while the nature of his alleged crime is important, it detracts from his incredible story about the dark path awaiting so many who join the ranks of inmates in America's prisons. Tony tells me about his struggle with addiction, his previous run-ins with the law, his loneliness, and eventual suicide attempt. Thank you for joining us. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning, Justin. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
I gotta tell you, I've been better, Justin. I've been better.
I don't doubt it. So, where are you right now, Tony?
Presently, I am at the only maximum security facility in Massachusetts.
And how long have you been there for?
In this facility, I just arrived just a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, and it seems likely I'm going to spend a good portion of my time here going forward.
So, just a little background. Those who I'm close with and who know and are familiar with Tony and his case do believe that Tony is innocent. And also, we're just going to keep Tony's last name off of the air and also the nature of his crime. He's got a very interesting story for us, and I just want to stick to that aspect of the radio show. So, Tony, how long have you been incarcerated?
All told, it's been close to 6.5 years.
Okay, yeah, that's a long time. The story that I really want to talk about, and I hate to glorify this, or hate is a strong word, but I don't want to glorify this, but it is an incredible story that you have that I've heard secondhand. And I just wanted to start with just some of the dark places that you visited when you first got incarcerated.
Okay. Well, as you know, you're fairly intimate with me and my case. When you're in a situation where you're looking at a lot of time, you know you're not guilty of the accusations, and you feel like you're fighting for your life, and in actuality, you are. At that point in time, life for me was pretty hopeless. You know, I'm looking at everything, trying to put a good face on, but in actuality, the system is geared towards convicting you, you know, and I found out quite early on that, you know, prosecutors and the system is more interested in conviction rather than truths, you know, so even if they feel there's exculpatory evidence that can acquit you, they'll leave that out or disallow it in favor of the way the system is.
Now, you were also at a disadvantage because you had a previous record.
Definitely. That will definitely handicap you. I think it's important to say that earlier in my life, right now I'm mid-40s, but earlier in my life, you know, I was heavily involved with drugs and drug addiction, and it led me to a lot of bad roads, a lot of bad decisions, and convictions and incarcerations, in fact, I'd like to put that out there as disclosure, full disclosure, but as you know, from when you actually met me, I turned my life around.
Yes.
Huge accomplishments. I own $1 million properties. I've gone from, a drug addict with no future to, guy running a pretty substantial company, making good money, and really doing the right thing, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'd just like to say for our listeners, Tony, that I have worked for you as a laborer and a carpenter, finished carpenter down in Nantucket, and you're an exceptionally hardworking individual and one of my favorite bosses that I've had, and I've had many.
Well, thank you. I think you're being kind.
So, after you were convicted, you had thoughts of suicide.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Once you see the trend, what I saw, the trend that was going on, that was happening before me, and the fact that regardless of whether I was acquitted, I wasn't acquitted, or anything else, my future was going to be in question. My business was going to my business reputation was going to be ruined, regardless of any outcome.
Because you were incarcerated while you were waiting for a verdict.
Let's backtrack.
Okay.
Actually, they gave me a bail, but it was hugely, out of my reach at the time, and everything just kind of seemed hopeless. And I guess this is what you're getting to. Where did that lead me? And where it led me was in the middle of a court proceeding, being transported from the courtroom to the holding area. I decided, while cuffed and shackled and escorted, I decided to jump head first off of a two-story balcony.
Wow.
And yes, that was an attempt to take my life. I had enough. I had nothing left to live for as far as I was concerned.
Right.
That's what led me. That's what happened. In the process of doing that, I obviously failed and, was brought to the hospital in the presence of court officers and police officers and whatnot. Well, when I went to the hospital, I had to take off all the shackles and manacles and all of that to give me an MRI to check out my neck and everything else, as I had, I had lacerations on my head and on my shoulder and whatnot. In the process, they obviously took off all the shackles and manacles. And after the MRI, I was brought back to the room, the emergency room, where I was being watched by a single court officer. While being watched by the court officer, I needed to use the restroom. Went into the restroom and saw that there was another door on the other side of the bathroom. Me being curious and desperate, really. I opened the door and saw that it led to another room. Well, I walked into that next room and walked out of the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I should tell you that I did this while wearing a Johnny and a pair of jeans and no footwear.
Oh, my God.
It was pretty wild. I'm sure I made quite a scene. Then, of course, now I get out of the hospital, what do you do? So I walked to the street, and there was a city bus going by. And so he stopped, and I went to get on the bus, and I said, hey, listen, I have no money on me. I just got out of the hospital. Do you think you could give me a ride downtown? And took one look at me and saw, I still had blood dripping from my hand from where the IVs, I had pulled out the IV apparatus that they had left on. And so the bus driver looks down at me. He's like, absolutely not. I cannot give you a ride. Well, no sooner did he leave, another bus pulled up right behind him. And I tried the same thing. I said, hey, listen, I just got out of the hospital. I don't have any money on me. Do you think I could get a ride, this, that, and the other? And I was like, sure, jump on. And there it was. I jumped on the bus and I was downtown and out of the area and off and running. And that lasted for a couple weeks. I spoke to a couple of friends and, they, of course, were sympathetic to me. They supplied me with money and everything else. And but really, to be honest with you, at the time, I was just really confused on what to do.
Yeah, that sounds like an incredible mental and spiritual transition.
To say the least, yeah. Actually. You're absolutely right. Yeah. You know, so that lasted a couple of weeks until the U.S. Marshals picked me up.
Did you have a plan at all when you left the hospital?
No. I mean, you know, they made a lot out of that. Yeah, they actually tried to piece it together as me planning this by jumping off, that the whole jumping over the balcony head first was a plan, and that, you know, I would then get brought to the hospital where I would make this escape and everything else. But what they're leaving out, I mean, that works great for their reports and their convict, you know, so they can convict me and everything. But the simple fact of the matter is, I'm not clairvoyant. When you jump off of a balcony two stories up, head first, shackled and manacled with a three-man escort, you certainly don't expect to live.
Right.
And even if you do, you don't expect that, wow, guess what? They're going to take you to the hospital, take off all your shackles and manacles. They're going to let you into a room that has a bathroom, that has a separate door that leads to the outside. You know, you're going to walk to the outside. The bus is going to stop. He's going to let you on. He's going to bring you down. You know, it's just,
that is... You know, that's like CSI Miami. That doesn't happen in real life.
It just does not. You know, clairvoyant, I am not. Obviously, or I wouldn't be here.
Completely true. Can you speak at all about the feeling that you had after the failed suicide attempt and then realizing that you weren't free, but you weren't in custody anymore?
Okay. The failed suicide attempt. You know, that...
And Tony, you know, anything that you're not comfortable talking about is totally fine.
I can talk... I'm good. As far as the failed suicide attempt, I don't know what I felt at that moment. I probably felt nothing. I think you kind of have to feel nothing in order to even go that route, you know? But then when I actually left the hospital, and, you know, this is how unplanned it was. As soon as I walked out the door, I was like, darn, what am I doing now? What, you know, what the hell did you just do?
Right.
But it's too late. You know, you're all in at that point. And, you know, you have to think on the fly and try to put together some type of a plan. I had none. And for, you will be the second person ever to know this about that time.
Listening.
And this is it. Is that you've known me for years. You know that I don't drink. You know that I don't do drugs. You know that I'm big into AA and sobriety and stuff like that.
Yes.
I can tell you that while out on the run, that there was one day where I didn't know what to do, and I bought some beers, and I just started drinking. Didn't know what I was going to do. I actually planned on jumping off of a building.
Wow.
For whatever reason, I didn't. And that was my one day of drinking since November 13th of 2000.
Wow.
The depression is what it is, and fortunately, a lot of good things have happened to me since then. Despite the conviction, despite everything else, I have good people in my life. I have obviously much to look forward to, despite the time that I'm looking at, the time that I have to do, and everything else. I have a good outlook. Well, so just to continue on my train of thought, you know, as of right now, facing everything that I'm facing as far as time and everything else, you know, I'm at a good place right now within myself, spiritually, within my life, as far as friends and loved ones go, and so I feel quite blessed in that regard. I'm so far away from where I was the day I actually jumped over that balcony and everything.
It sounds like it.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's despite the fact that, you know, I'm in the worst prison there is in Massachusetts. You know, that probably half of the population is here for murder. Last month they took a counselor hostage. The month before, they went and stabbed a correctional officer in the neck.
Wow.
And there's much gang violence. There's a lot of there's a lot of animosity. There's a lot of hopelessness. There's a lot of anger.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so that is what it is, and you have to deal with it. You know, that set all of that aside, and in spite of all of that, you know, I'm still in a much better place, and you know, with a good outlook. As it sits right now today, Justin, I feel pretty blessed, even with all of the, you know, all of the difficulties I have at the moment and lying ahead of me. I have so much to look forward to and be thankful for. It's obvious I'll probably never be able to go back into the field that I was in, given that my reputation is now destroyed and everything else. But, hey, you know, I look on the bright side, and I'm thankful for the things I do have, you know. That's pretty much where I'm at there, brother.
That's amazing. Do they have AA in the jail?
They do it. But it's so infrequent, and it's not like a regularly scheduled thing. So, and then the other part of it is that because I do have that escape on my record, that limits what I can participate in and where I can go within the prison as well. And as a matter of fact, because of my status, I'm what they call level A, which is the highest security status there is. Because of that status, you know, they have to move me, or they don't have to, but they do move me every 30 days from cell to cell. Because God forbid, you know, I might be chiseling through the wall, you know what I mean?
Jeez.
Every 30 days is a move to a different cell within the same block, but it's a pain. I guess it's the price of doing business when you walk out of a hospital, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can imagine. Was there a particular moment of transition that helped you come to terms with your situation?
You know, I can't narrow it down to a specific date. I can narrow it down to a time frame. And I have to tell you that it really was when I was still awaiting trial before I ever even got sentenced. And some friends of mine who you know very, very well decided that regardless of everything that was being said, regardless of the aura of negativity that was surrounding me, they were not going to bail on me. They were not going to let me go through this alone. They wanted to be there with me. They wanted to be my friends, and they wanted to represent friendship and love to me. And I think that them coming through that cloud of judgment and that cloud of doubt and you know, just really overall hatred. This seems to go with people who are incarcerated and who supposedly did wrong and everything else. You know, to see their way through that for sure gave me something to build upon.
Right.
You know, was it the end-all, be-all tidings and good fortune and everything else? No. But it was the peak of sunshine. It was the light at the end of the tunnel, and I knew it wasn't a train coming back and you'd run me down. You know what I'm saying?
I can only imagine. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, you didn't have any family to turn to.
Well, my family, for the most part, I mean, my, you know, my mother's been dead for years, my father's been dead for years. My family's very dysfunctional, what's left of it.
Yep.
And they're not very tight. I mean, you know, that was that. And as far as in-laws and stuff, you know, I was at impasse at crossroads, and they were totally against me. So I didn't have that side of family as well. So no. So that was my feeling. You know, my my family was my friends who saw me through.
Are there additional court dates coming up in which you'll find more out about your sentence?
No. There's no court dates. All that is left now is there's parole dates. There's parole dates, but they're not conclusive. They're not solid dates because we have what they call good time, you know, time that you can earn off of your sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that will impact my parole date, my release date. So there's not a solid date in which, you know, in which I can say, oh, well, this is the day I will be out. It all right. depends on how much good time I can earn, you know, how much trouble I can stay out of, and how many programs and work and stuff I can get into.
Right. Do they have programs available to you that will help you accumulate good time?
Yes and no. They have programs available. The problem with it is that you have to sit on a waiting list in which, you know, to get into these programs. So, like, I'm on a list right now for a culinary arts program. I'm on a list for a barber school program. And I'm on a list for a computer program. Each one of those programs, you can get good time for. The barbershop and the culinary arts, you get 10 days off of your sentence a month.
That's great.
The computer's 5 days. Mm-hmm. However, the waiting list can be 18 months long just to get into them. So in the meantime, you could be earning zero good time. Again, the whole escape thing, it leaves me ineligible for many jobs that are outside of the housing unit.
Of course. Will that be for the remainder of your sentence?
Well, it's not supposed to. Now I'm actually in the process of appealing some of those decisions. Those are institutional decisions. They're Department of Corrections decisions. They have nothing to do with the court.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually in the process of dealing with the administration for the Department of Corrections and for the jail to see if I can get some of that alleviated. I can get some of that lifted. And yes, there's actually supposed to be a time frame in which they can no longer use it against you, and the actual time frame is supposed to be 10 years, which it would be 10 years from the date of the incident, and since that was 6.5 years ago, it would be 3.5 years from basically from now.
Well, at least you're over the halfway point.
As a matter of fact, it doesn't have to take 10 years either. So there are options. There is, you know, there is a bit of wiggle room if they're willing to give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
They have discretion.
Well, Tony, that is an incredible story. Thank you for joining me.
You got it, Justin. Anything for you, buddy. You're one of my favorite people.
Thank you, Tony. I really appreciate it.
America goes nuts for these stories on television. The American crime drama is perhaps the most popularly watched television in the country. Justice and law, mixed with entertainment and horror, bring gruesome and terrifying scenes to the comfort of our living rooms. While the object of this obsession finds its home on the Hollywood set, it also happens in real life, and surprisingly, not just to the victims. The script sometimes comes alive, and it is rarely a happy ending in which the good guys always win, the bad guys always lose, and we all go to bed after brushing our teeth. I hope that in the end, Tony's story will follow the script of a Hollywood drama. That he really is innocent, that someday all will be forgiven, and there will be a happy reunion with friends and family before the credits roll. That light he sees at the end of the tunnel really isn't a train coming down the tracks, like it is for so many trapped in the American justice system. Thanks again for joining me. I'm Justin Chapin for Prison Pipeline on KBOO.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone. Neath a halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stabbed by the flash of a neon light, split the night and touch the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more, people talking without